Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Happy May. This is the home of the Indianapolis 500, 1070 The Fan, WFNI Indianapolis. I'm Kevin Lee. Thanks for joining us for the first of our nightly conversations with Donald Davidson and the Talk of Gasoline Alley, the first of a two-hour block talking about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the IZOD IndyCar Series. At 7 o'clock on weeknights following this program, Kurt Cavan from the Indianapolis Star will join me for Trackside with Cavan and Kevin. That's where we'll talk about the now and controversy, if you like, but this will remain a show devoted to nostalgia. Donald, it is a privilege to be here sitting with you.
Thank you, Kevin.
And
I don't do controversy.
We know that. I've heard the program before. We'll take care of that. First of all, congratulations on the Hall of Fame.
Thank you very much.
Had several emails to pass along to you. A lot of the listeners are very excited for you. To be honest, I was a bit surprised that this had not been taken care of at some point in the past, but there's always a time when those things happen.
I'm just a kid. But no, it takes place on May the 27th, and it's huge for me because I've never been a participant. I'm an enthusiast. And for somebody like me, it's a huge honor.
I think for contributions for the Speedway and for those that have come along with you and after you, it's very well deserved. So congratulations to Donald for the Auto Racing Hall of Fame. Jim Travers and Frank Kuhn are the other inductees coming up May 27th at the Marriott downtown. And this May will be your 47th consecutive year on the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network. According to this, is that accurate? Does that include 64? Let's do the math.
I've been on the network crew. This is 46, but I was a guest in 64. So it'll be 47.
Yeah, we're going to count it.
You made and an you know appearance. What? This show that we're doing right now, it started in 1971. So it's 39 years, but this is actually the 40th season straight for this show on the same wavelength.
And you did a variation
in 1966.
Extent, that's what I thought.
I did a 15-minute show in 1966, and then for a variety of reasons, we did it. It got revived again in 71, and then it's been straight ever since then.
Well, something is working. We were going to go to your phone calls coming up in just a moment. The telephone number is 317-239-1070. 239-1070. Questions for Donald Davidson. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley. It's May in Indianapolis, and 1070 The Fan. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. Along with Donald Davidson, I'm Kevin Lee. Telephone number is the same as it has been for many, many years. The frequency is the same here on 1070. The call letters have changed. It's WFNI, but this year the Indianapolis 500 will again air on WIBC on the FM side, 93 WIBC, and here on 1070 The Fan. And 1070 The Fan is also going to be your home for all of the extended programming, not only this show and Trackside, but track updates throughout the week plus of action at the track, a complete continuous coverage of qualifications and much more. And there's also going to be action and activity on 93 WIBC as far as some updates and other programming as well. Well, let's jump into it and get to telephone calls for Donald tonight. We start off with Mike. Hello, Mike. You're on the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.
Hello,
Donald.
Mike.
This is Mike from Vernon Hills, Illinois. How are you?
Oh, fine, Mike. Good. Congratulations. You got the first one.
Yeah, I feel like Larry Basilia.
Ah!
Mine. Hey, let me first congratulate you on the Hall of Fame. It's well-deserved.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So usually we're talking about gunslingers from the 50s and 60s, but given the Sentinel area, I wonder if you could talk about Johnny Aitken.
Oh, golly, yes. I don't think we've ever been asked about him before. Johnny Aitken actually has numerous firsts at the Speedway. Probably the most notable would be that he was the first driver ever to lead the 500. He started on the outside of the front row. Was actually started fourth, but we had five abreast starts. So how could he start on the outside and be fourth? Well, that's because the pace car the first year was in the position that we now call the pole position. And then four cars next to him, Johnny Aitken was on the outside of the front row, and he led into the first turn and led the first four laps. He already had a number of firsts. He is the I don't know if this is a correct term, but winningest driver of the pre 500 period. And I don't remember how many events that was. But it was like 10 or 11 events that he won of the races that were in 09 and 10 before they ever even thought of having a 500, when they would run a number of races in one day. He is the person, he worked for the National Motor Vehicle Company. He's the guy who tested the first portion of bricks when the crushed rock and tar in 1909. They realized very quickly that they'd made a mistake, so they were looking at other surfaces. But instead of ordering the entire 3,200,000 bricks in one go, they had a shipment come in. They put an area down on the main straightaway, put the mortar down, and then said, all right, let's test it. And Johnny Aiken was the guy that tested it, and he would go up the track just a little bit. It couldn't have been very far because they only put down a short stretch, and he would stand on it and then get on the brakes. And then the next thing they did was to drive a stake in the ground and put chains to the axle somehow, and then said, all right, stand on it. And then he would actually just spin the tires with the car not going anywhere and all the smoke pouring off. The idea being to see if they could disturb the surface. And when he shut it down and they found that the surface had not been disturbed, then they thought, all right, bring in 3,200,000 of these things and we'll pave the entire track. So he did that test. When they were getting ready to finish up the job, he was the guy that went out and tested it. And there's a variety of other things, too, where he first. He actually retired after the 1911 season and then was the pit manager for Joe Dawson, winning in 1912. And when the foreigners came over for the first time in 1913, he was given to the Peugeot team, and he actually was the strategist for Jules Gou winning in 1913. Hmm. So he had two wins as a team manager. By 1915, he was back driving again, and he was a relief driver for the Stutz team and ended up co-driving the car that finished third with Gil Anderson and the one that was fourth with Earl Cooper. And then in 1916, back as a fully-fledged driver, he won the pole, led the early stages, dropped out, and in September, I think it was like September the 12th or something like that, they did something that they had not done since 1910, nor would they again till 1994, and that is have an additional program. And they actually had three races in one day using the same cars that would run in the 500. They ran, they had a 20-mile race, 8 laps, 50-mile, which was 20 laps, and then 100-mile, which was 40 laps, and all on the same day. And Johnny Aiken won all three with the Peugeot. And then the first year for the national championship was that year, the first year in which points were paid. And again, I kind of had this annual soapbox thing where there's been published results for some time with points dating back to 1909. It was a figment of somebody's imagination that was made up in the early 1950s. There was no points championship till 1916. Dario Resta won it, and Johnny Aiken was second. And he was in the process of retiring again because he'd been very closely aligned with Carl Fisher and James Allison. And when the Indianapolis Speedway Team Company became the Allison Experimental Company and then Allison Engineering, Aiken was on board. And he was actually a vice president of Allison when it was brand new. And in fact, when he died in 1918, he contacted the flu. There was a flu epidemic. And in mid-November of 1918, he passed away. Anyway, that's Johnny Aiken. Thank mm-hmm. you. I don't haven't been asked about him for a while.
So there was no race in 1917?
So, 1917 and 18, there was no race because of World War I.
He raced in the last race that he was available.
Yes, he was on the pole.
So he was still an active driver.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you for the question, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Ed joins us next from Dallas, Texas. Hello, Ed. You're on the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.
Hello, Donald.
Hi, Ed. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
I was going to ask you about a famous car, but first I want to congratulate you for being with the Speedway for 47 years now.
Oh, that's the radio network. I haven't been with the Speedway that long.
Well,
thanks.
That's what I mean.
Okay.
I had downloaded the 1964 race off of the Speedway website. And about just a little over 3 hours and 50 minutes into it, you can hear Sid Collins talk to you for the very first time. And I remember he just asked you a random question. He mentioned Fred Frame, and
yes.
Suddenly we knew everything was about Fred Frame.
Yeah.
But my question was about Old Calhoun.
Okay. What would you like to hear about it?
Well, I know that car raced from 1960 to 64. The first year it was raced by Lloyd Ruby.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And then Parnelli Jones took it over. But what I never could understand is it was the same car all those years. However, between 60 and 64, they managed to make that car go about 11 miles an hour faster. So I don't know if it was a different engine.
I can tell you the 11 miles an hour would be, it was a steady climb until from 63 to 64, it was tires. And they went to wider tires, and that's why there's the huge jump, because he went from 151, which was the track record in 63, and then I think he qualified, what was it, like 155, 156 or something like that in 1964. About that, my visit to the booth in 1964, I had a very English accent at that time, and while you would think that probably I was falling over myself to get a copy of the broadcast, I never actually heard that, or I heard a segment of it. And it wasn't until fairly recent years, perhaps maybe 10 years ago, that I finally heard a little bit more. And what I never knew was that after I left the booth, Sid Collins and Fred Agabation continued to talk about me after I had gone. Because I remember Fred Frame was the driver that I was asked about. And I had just got maybe, you know, I'd barely started on it. And Sid said, Donald, we're going to have to interrupt you because there's so-and-so's coming in for a pit stop. And so, but great, thank you for being here. And I left. And I did not know that they talked about me after I'd gone. So I wish they were both deceased by the time I learned that. But anyway, Calhoun, the jump in speed would be because of tires. The other thing was that they kept changing the aerodynamic. Johnny Paulson was the chief mechanic, Frank McGurk was the mechanic in 60 when Ruby drove it, and the car was red. And then in the subsequent years, it was Johnny Paulson. And he was a big aerodynamicist, and they kept changing the front end of it every year. Kevin, you had a question?
Well, and they also paved the remainder of the track after 61.
That is correct, yes.
So it went to all asphalt. It was
sure.
The main straight was still bricks in 1961.
Good point. In fact, when Parnelli broke the 150-mile-an-hour barrier, that was the first year in which the rest of the straightaway, in 60 and 61, it was about 630 yards was bricks and mortar. Yeah, good point.
And so, I was brushed up on that fact by taking Donald's class at IUPUI, so I've heard that fact again recently. Anything else, Ed?
I'm sure I'll think of something, but we have all month long, right?
Excellent.
All right.
Call us back. Thank you. 239-1070 is our number. Lines are full, so when you hear someone leave us like Ed just did, that's your cue to call in. 317-239-1070. By the way, before I forget, people have asked me this several times in the last few days, and I guess I'll confirm this on the air. I understand this will be available in a podcast form. Yes, it will. Matt Taylor will take care of that, and Trackside Following will also be available podcasted at 1070thefan.com. But we encourage you to listen to us live here, either on 1070 AM in Indianapolis or live streaming on 1070thefan.com. Robert is up next in Frankfort, Indiana. Hello, Robert. Welcome to the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson.
Thank you very much. This is just, I'm just so excited and extremely honored to talk to Donald. I turn into an 11-year-old kid on the month of May, and I go back to 1969. Which was the first race I ever got to go to, and of course Mario Andretti won that. And but it's like Christmas. Instead of hearing, you know, White Christmas on the 1st of May, it's like I'm dreaming of hearing Donald Davidson.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
So it's just an honor and a privilege, and I also want to say congratulations. But I got a couple quick questions.
Okay.
Not really historical, but. This is going to be the first poll day that I'm going to miss in 25 years. and I'm so despondent about it, but I'm going to be in Jasper, Indiana, and I didn't know what affiliate it would be that I could tune into down there to be able to listen to Poll Day.
Well, it's on 1070. Would you not be able to reach it down in Jasper? I would think so.
Do you think I can? I'm not for sure if I can down that far.
I think there's a decent chance you can.
During the day and heading south, I would think so.
During the day, I think you can. The other way, I think IndyCar.com in the past has listed our affiliates, but I also understand that different affiliates... they may be an affiliate, but they might not air everything, so that's not going to be a real certainty. I suppose you could look up radio stations in Jasper and call them and ask them, maybe a request that they carry the broadcast, or I'll write this down, and I'll see if I can get a list, and if you want to send me an email right before that weekend, so about 2 weeks from now, I'll see if I can get with our network general manager and find if we have an accurate list of affiliates for that day.
And what would that email address be?
Kevin@1070thefan.com.
Kevin@1070thefan.com. Okay, wonderful.
Okay.
Appreciate that. And then just one more quick question for Donald.
Sure. Okay.
The new chassis coming to be here in the next, well, in June. Of course, I'd read in the past that whoever gets that awarded precious prize, has each one of those companies guaranteed, Donald, that they will relocate to Indianapolis to produce that chassis?
I know that that's being discussed, and I don't know if that's an absolute requirement or not. I know that's being discussed, or certainly within certainly fairly close to the track. I think Indiana rather than Indianapolis per se. Although it would make sense that they did in Indianapolis, but I'll tell you what, I'm not very good on the present and the future. I basically do the past.
That's a question for Trackside, as
right.
I understand. I think Donald has described it accurately, that it's a preference, but I don't know that it's a make or break. There are a lot of different variables involved, and that would be one thing in a chassis manufacturer's advantage if they were going to build in Indianapolis. But if they find everything else that they like, cost, distribution, the type of look of the car, and everything else, and it's not made in Indianapolis, it wouldn't necessarily be a deal breaker. So, and by the way, Matt tells us that you can pick up 1070 in Jasper, Indiana.
Very good.
So, so there's probably your best option. You can get 1070 during the daytime just about everywhere in the state of Indiana.
Jasper's where Spike Gelhausen was raised.
Okay. Robert, I'm glad you called tonight. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. 239-1070 is our telephone number. Susan is up with us next on the Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson. Hello, Susan.
Hey, how are you guys?
Fine, Susan.
Hey, Donald, it's Susan Varanek. How are you?
I thought that might be you. I'm fine. Now, why would you be calling?
Well, first of all, congratulations to you. Nobody deserves it more.
Thank you.
Really thrilled about that. Secondly, would you tell all of us the story of how A.J. Foyt came to the track with no money, just a father and a lot of good ideas, and Mr. Hallman helped him?
Well, I don't know where you might be going with this, but Foyt's, I think you might have a couple of things running together there. I know that Foyt did meet Tony Hallman before he ever drove because he was a friend of Elmer and Mary through driving midgets. The first time that he came to the track was either 53 or 54. He's not sure, but Vukovich won the race when he came. He came with a bunch of friends out from Texas, and in fact, that it's not the whole reason, but that's partially why he leaned towards 14 as a car number. It's not all of the reason, but at the back of the mind was the fact that it did very well for Vukovich, winning in 53 and 54. Anyway, in 56, he came up and would have witnessed the race because he towed up a midget. He was 21 by that time. And towed up a midget, which he ran in the three USAC races across the street the night before the 500. In fact, of the three separate programs, I know we've talked about this many times in the past, where they would start in the afternoon and they have a complete show of midget racing with qualifying, hot laps, qualifying heats, and semi and a feature. And then they would clear everybody out of the grandstands and then sell tickets to another program. And they'd start completely fresh again with more hot laps and qualifying and heats and semi and feature. And that would be over, you know, but like, you know, 9, 10 o'clock at night, they clear everybody out and do it again. And then the final checkered flag was usually like 2:30 in the morning. Anyway, in 56, Foyt attempted to qualify for all three, and he made two of the three features, and I think was 13th in one and 14th in the other. But in 1957, early, they ran a bunch of midget races. A man named Ashley Wright, who was a car owner, hardwood door specials, he ran a series of races down in Florida, and they called it the Tangerine Tournament. And I think they ran like probably 12 races or something like that. And Elmer and Mary George were down there with their midget. In fact, they weren't even Elmer and Mary George yet. They were Elmer George and Miss Mary Holman. Mm-hmm. And she was driving his midget because they got married, I think, after that series would have come to a conclusion, I think. But it was over about a month or so down there. And at some point, Elmer and Foyt had become friends, so he was invited to come on to the yacht of the parents of his bride-to-be, and that's when he went, as Foyt would call it, Mr. and Ms. Holman. Ms. Holman is what he called Mary Fendrick Holman. So the other part, I don't know what, Susan, exactly what
so
you
that was 57?
At. That was 57.
And his first 500 was 58?
That's correct. Boy, okay. You're good. And that was coming in with the Dean Van Line special, which was a great opportunity. He started driving championship cars in the summer of 57.
Okay.
But Jimmy Bryan wanted to drive the car that Sam Hanks had won with. And as George Sally told him, we don't have a dirt car, Jim. We only do the speedway. And he said, that's okay. I've been thinking of cutting back anyway. So Clint Barner and Al Dean had to find another driver. And they selected, after going with three-time national champion Jimmy Bryan, they decided to take a chance on this newcomer, A.J. Foyt.
So he got it simply on merit? He got the opportunity because of what he had done in the ranks coming up?
Okay. That's how it used to be.
Yeah,
yes.
I know. But I think that was something that Susan was talking about, there was some different ways of raising funding, but Foyt was not one of those that had to do something extreme to get the first opportunity.
Driver had to do that in those days. Just the owners looked for the drivers. All the driver had to do was stand on the gas.
When did that first start? When?
Oh, golly. Well, actually, you know, before World War One.
That's what I think.
Some of it. But for many years, not. In Europe and South America and the rest of the world, it's always been that way. I mean, that's right back to the very beginning, where the driver sort of financed the thing himself and either had the wherewithal or either he was wealthy or had the wherewithal to raise the funds. And it probably when in the mid 60s, when sports car drivers started to come in, there were those that what one European put it so politely, it was known as helping to share with the expenses.
Yeah.
And I remember that some drivers started to they would show up and they go to car owners and say, look, I've got, $5,000 or $10,000. And then it wasn't long before the owner started thinking, hey, this is great. We've always hired the drivers and then tried to get a sponsor to offset the expense if we already didn't have one. But if the guy's going to bring it, then we can just sit back and wait and do the best deal.
They do the selling for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else, Susan?
No, that's it. He did a great job, just like I knew he would.
Okay.
Okay, thanks,
Thank
Susan.
You for calling. 239-1070 is our number. Dave and Marion is up with us next. Hello, Dave. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Donald. Take us back to the 30s and 40s for a while, please. Rex Mays.
Okay, then. This could take a few moments. Kevin, what do we need to take a
We're
break
fine.
Or just keep going?
We're
All
fine.
Right. All right. Rex Mays was... his tenure at the Speedway was 1934 to 1949, and I'll try and sort of condense this rather than go through year by year. And he was pretty much I use the term wonder boy, but I mean he was young. I mean he was only 21 when he came to the Speedway, and clean cut, fresh faced youth, and at a time when there weren't a lot of fresh-faced youth at the Speedway, but he was already very successful on the West Coast. He'd finished second in the West Coast Championship, most of the races being at the Legion Ascot Speedway, and just outside of L.A., and he was runner-up in the points, and it wasn't just a handful of races. I mean, they had long seasons, so he was second in points in 33. At the Speedway, his second year, he won the pole, and at the age of 22, and to this day continues to be the youngest pole winner ever. And so he won the pole in 35 and 36. He also won it in 40 and 48. So he was the only four-time pole winner until Rick Mears came along, another RM. But anyway, Rex drove in 12 races. He led 9, and I stumbled on this stat because he was a two-time runner-up for many, many years, and probably much still, when the discussion comes up about who were the great drivers that never won that should have, it used to be Rex Mays was the first name you would hear. There's a few others to throw in the mix now, but he's still way up there. And Michael Andretti, I hope, isn't listening because he won't want to hear this stat, but until he came along, Rex Mays had the record for the most number of laps led by a driver who had never won. But when I was fiddling around some stats quite a few years ago, I found this very interesting, that of the 12 starts, and he led 9 races, the latest lap that he ever led was 99. So he never led a single lap in the second half. In addition to the 4 poles, I think he was on the front row 3 other times. And the best finishes, as I said, were second, or if I didn't say, I'll say it now, second in 40 and 41. And then the final start was 1949 when he drove an Ovi and was Duke Nagland's teammate and started second and led that one also. And then he lost his life in an accident. The only time they ran championship cars on at Del Mar horse track. And yeah, I know, an odd venue, but that's why they would go to horse tracks and to run. And anyway, he was thrown out and then run over by another driver. And like everybody else, just about, he chose to not wear a seatbelt. And there was quite a move after that because, I mean, he was much admired. He was everybody's hero. And the fact that, you know, Rex Mays could be fatally injured was just unthinkable. You know, he just figured to be invincible. And so Wilbur Shaw was a great advocate for getting seatbelts used, although he didn't quite get that done. And it was not a rule for many, many years. And the thinking being, when it was up to the drivers, and I thought a lot about this when the Hans device came in and not everybody wanted to wear it, and I'm sort of getting off the subject a little bit. But
that's a good point to make. The fear was...
Well, the thing was, the drivers, when they were front-engine cars, they would rather get thrown out.
And burn.
And then ride it out. Well, whether there was fire or not, I mean, just the fact that they felt they could get injured worse by flipping in a front-engine car and going end over end than if they got thrown out. So Roger Ward was the driver rep on the USAC board for many years. And whenever that would come up, they'd say, okay, Roger, what do you think? And he said, well, as the driver's rep, he said, the fellows still don't like him. He said they would rather be thrown out. And this is the point that stuck with me when the Hans device came along. He said, now, personally, I wear one, but that's my choice. And he said, I don't think we should tell the fellows that they have to.
Roll bars. I've seen the pictures of the cars, and it seems like even in the 50s, the roll bars were below their head.
Yeah, they were not mandatory until January 1st of 59 is when roll bars became mandatory.
It just seems like
I know, but how about uniforms? Fire treated uniforms were not mandatory until halfway through May of 59. So you could start out taking your rookie test driving a T-shirt, in a T-shirt.
Dave, thank you for the call.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you both.
Okay, we'll talk to you again. All right, more of your thoughts to come. There's now a line available, 239-1070, 317-239-1070. It's our season debut of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 The Fan. I'm Kevin Lee. Donald Davidson is here to answer your questions, 317-239-1070. All lines are full right now. When someone leaves us, that's your cue to call. Now it's time to play this week's Inspire Indianapolis 500 Fun Fact Challenge. Answer the following fun fact correctly, and you could win tickets to Community Day and be qualified for the race weekend grand prize, a two-night stay at the Omni Severin Hotel, breakfast for two, and two tickets to the 500 Festival Parade and Indianapolis 500, courtesy of Indianapolis Downtown, Inc. Downtown Indianapolis, amazingly always new. This week's fun fact challenge is, what year was the first 500 Festival Parade? To play today's Inspire Indianapolis 500 Fun Fact Challenge, go to the Fun Fact Challenge link at Indianapolis500coverage.com. Indianapolis500coverage.com. If you're not sure of the answer, there's a handy research link to Inspire, Indiana's virtual library free to all Hoosiers, right on the contest page. Submit your answer. Go to the Fun Fact Challenge link at Indianapolis500coverage.com. Indianapolis500coverage.com.
I know the answer to that.
You're not allowed to participate, Donald. I know the answer, too. I wrote the questions.
Oh, all right. Then. Okay.
239-1070 is our number. Who has been waiting the longest? It is Jay from St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Jay.
Hello, Jay.
Hey, Donald.
Oh, thanks for calling in.
It's been a long year. Okay, Donald, I just have a couple questions. We'll see how long they take. One is, did the winning car ever take the checkered flag with a relief driver who's basically uncredited?
No.
Okay. Second one is, if you go back to pre-75 Indianapolis 500s, were there races where the running order at the time the winner took the checkered flag was a lot different than the final results?
Oh, that could be. Let me follow up on the first question, because that asking about was there an uncredited relief driver at the wheel in the winning car? No, because when there's actually six occasions on which the winning car was driven by a second person, and four of them don't get credit, and that's Cyrus Patchkey in 1911, Don Herr for Joe Dawson in 1912, Howdy Wilcox for Tommy Milton in 23, and then Norman Batten for Peter DiPaolo in 25. They do not generally get credit because they relieved midway through the race and then the original driver got back in. The other two occasions, you had Corum starting and Joe Boyer taking over to win in 24, and then Floyd Davis handing over to Maury Rose to win in 41. And because one driver started and the other one finished, they decided to declare co-winners. But from second on back, very often it was another guy that bought the car to the checker, and he doesn't get any credit at all. As far as major changes in the results, there would be what he's referring to is the fact that now the white flag comes out, then the checker, then you just simply checker everybody that comes by, and that's the end of the race. But what they used to do was to try and get at least 10 cars, if possible, go 500 miles, and so the thing would go on for quite some time. And there would be occasions where people would have a mechanical problem late, or run out of fuel or whatever it was after the winner had already crossed the line. In fact, probably the main example of that would be in 1936, when for 500 miles the fuel allotment was 37.5 gallons, and there were four cars that dropped out in the final laps while running within the first 10. And whether or not Louis Meyer had already taken the checkered flag by the time the first one ran out, I have no idea. But it did allow Wilbur Shaw, for instance, in 1936, to go from 10th to 7th in the final laps simply by people having problems, running out of fuel. by which time Louis Meyer would have won the race. So I can't think of anything other than that. It's possible 63. Nah, the timing wouldn't quite be right. But anyway, there have been people that have dropped out within the first 10 late. So it's possible that, you know, some people had a chance to pick up maybe one position after the winner had crossed the line.
Hmm. Okay,
Jay? That's a good question, Jay. Thank you.
Thank you, Donald.
Tom is up with us next. Hi, Tom. You're on 1070 The Fan and the Talk of Gasoline Alley.
Hi, Donald.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling in.
Sure. On behalf of my family, I want to congratulate you. You were a friend of my uncle, Leonard Wexler.
Oh, yes. I remember Wex.
He'd be smiling from above about that, but I have a quick question for you, if you can.
Okay.
Don't mind feeling it. When I was a young man, I was very much into drag racing, and my uncle called me one day and he said, "Hey, come out to the track after school today. I got a surprise for you." Well, I go out, go to his office there in Gasoline Alley, and there sits Benny Ungaius, and he introduced me to him. And it was just the highlight, of course, of the whole month for me. But I wondered if you could give some insight on how Danny made such a, at least seemed to me, a quick transition from drag racing to open wheel. Or how he evolved that way.
Well, actually, he had wanted to do it much earlier than he did. It was 1977 when he first came to the Speedway to drive. But, well, you have to phrase that differently. It's not the first time he was an entered driver. He was actually entered in 1968, and that was for Mickey Thompson. And he was turned down because of the fact that he was very limited on open cockpit, open wheel experience. In fact, really any kind of racing experience. And I think he did run a sprint car at Ascot Park a few times, but really hadn't raced very much. And then in the interim, he did quite a bit of road racing and was befriended by Ted Field of the Marshall Field family in Chicago. And that's how he came to the Speedway. Actually, they went to Ontario. His first start, I believe his first start was the Ontario 576. And so then he showed up with the Interscope Special. And a little story there that for several years, Danny Ungaius drove Interscope Specials. And they had no sponsor most of the years. And it was because some companies that were looking to do sponsorship, they would look at the entry list. Back in the days when the sponsors went looking for the cars, and they thought, well, Interscope, okay, well, they've got a sponsor, thinking that it was a product, and it wasn't. It was a name that Ungaius and Ted Field made up. But he was exceedingly brave. He had a lot of accidents. He was injured several times, but he always seemed to come back. But when he did show up the first time, he was really limited on racing experience, and there was one right before him, Art Malone, who drove the Novi one of the Novis for Granatelli in 1963, had run very few actual races prior to coming here.
What kind of success did he have as a drag racer?
Oh, Ungaius?
Yeah.
Oh, huge.
That's what
he's a legend. Yes, he was.
Really? I didn't know he was a legend. I knew he had some success.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, no, huge. In fact, in Funny Car, when it was fairly new, but also Top Fuel, in 1966, he was in the finals. A fellow named Mike Snively won the Top Fuel final in '66, and Ungaius was the runner up. But I think he won the Winter Nationals, and no, he was legendary in drag racing.
Okay, Tom.
Well,
I remember Wex very well. In fact,
yeah.
just real quick, I got a photograph. I'm going to make a copy for somebody that I've had a lot of fun with. I think it was about 1968, and it was a talk I did with Sid Collins and Andy Granatelli, and we were at the Holiday Inn across the street from the track, which is even gone now. And it was Leonard Wexler and Sid and myself and Andy, and on the marquee right behind us, underneath the famous Holiday Inn sign, it says, "Welcome Sid Collins and Donald Davidson," and Granatelli's not up there. But no, I remember Wex very well. He took me to quite a few talks, and we had a lot of fun together.
Well, I'll be at my 52nd race this year with his son. One of his sons comes from Denver every year, and we go together. So
is that Lenny or one of the others?
No, that's Frank.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Frank.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, nice talking to you,
Thank
Donald.
You.
Thank you, Tom. By the way, a clarification in our Indianapolis 500 Fun Fact Challenge. I'm now told the website that you want to go to is Indy500Coverage.com, which is why I'm reading this, because I know you don't like to refer to it as Indy 500.
I had a
because
lot of
I do
fun
remember this
year.
Coming in when you were reading this last year, that I think you made a reference that
I did.
I have to say it, so I will say it.
I know.
In this
well,
fashion.
Matt arranged for it to be changed so that I wouldn't have to say it. Now you're doing it anyway, so it's
but
okay.
But it's Indy500Coverage.com is where you can find all the information and look to the link Inspire, Indiana's virtual library free to all Hoosiers, to tell us the first year of the 500 Festival Parade. We continue at 239-1070, and Jeremy is up next here in Indianapolis. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, how you doing today, Donald?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, I was calling about, you know, one of the traditions of the 500 is the Gordon Pipers. Just calling to see if you could give me a little history on that with the 500, how it all came to happen.
All right. I think their first year was 62 or maybe 63. And supposedly they were at Raceway Park and struck up a relationship with Tony Holman. And so they started appearing at the track. And my first year was 64. And, of course, Jim Clark was big news. And here were the – I didn't expect to see, you know, a bagpipe band at the track. And so one would think, well, it's because of Jim Clark. Well, it wasn't. Just the timing was – was there, and they've participated every year. So I don't know how long the band, if I can call it a, you know, some people call it a pipe band, and I don't know if anybody would take offense to that. But I'm not sure how long that had been going before that time, but certainly ever since. And it was Dr. Gordon Deal, I think, was the man that. If he didn't start it, he certainly was the figurehead.
Sir.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy. Ed is next with us on 1070 The Fan and the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Go ahead, Ed.
How you guys doing?
Just fine, thanks.
Great.
I got a trivia question for Donald.
Okay.
Okay. What is the, and I don't know the answer to it either, so. Well,
good, because maybe I don't either.
I know the answer to half of it.
Okay.
What's the fewest amount of miles a driver has ran to win the race, and what's the most miles a driver has run to run the race?
Well, on the latter part, you're probably talking about Jacques Villeneuve in 1995, when he actually, it's kind of a gray area, because how many laps did he complete? 200. He actually was, he was given a two-lap penalty. Yeah. And whether that was right or not, I do have my personal questions about that, because I saw something that happened, and it certainly couldn't have been very clear to him. But anyway, regardless, he was given a two-lap penalty and then was able to make it up. Now, did he do 202 laps on the track during actual competition? Not really. What happened was he was able to work it out. Not that it would be easy to work out, but let's just say that it was fortuitous on two occasions where the yellow would come out and he would be ahead of the leader. Mm-hmm. And so was able to pack up, if you like, and he was able to do that twice. As far as the fewest number of laps to win the race, I'm not quite sure what you might mean by this, but probably you're either looking at Johnny Rutherford with 102 laps in 1976 in a race that was called because of rain, or it could be that you're considering the co-winners and it would have to be Floyd Davis with 72 laps in 1941 because of the Coram and Boyer change took it 109. So Coram went 109, and then Boyer went 91. So the fewest number would be Floyd Davis with 72 laps in 41. But that's two occasions of co-winners, and if you want just the one winner, then once again it would be Rutherford in 76 with 102 laps. So hopefully one of the answers is in there.
Thank you very much.
Okay, which one did you want, or did you not know?
Well, I knew Villeneuve, but I thought he was credited for going 202 laps.
No, 200. I mean,
because they essentially take two laps away.
Yeah, because they said he did 202. Well, two laps were taken away, and then he was able to make them up by not really wave arounds. But I mean, it was effectively a wave around. He just happened to be in front of the leader when the yellow came out. And so everything is frozen, and then you pack up. And if you happen to be just ahead of the leader and about to be lapped, or you just got by him or whatever, then, you can make up a 2.5 mile lap. And
okay.
He did that twice.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed. By the way, Rick emails this and says, yes, it was Gordon Deal, was the founder of the Gordon Pipers.
Okay, very good.
Joe is with us next from Terre Haute here on 1070 The Fan with Donald Davidson. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how's it going, Kurt? And Donald, thanks a lot for everything you guys do for racing. I wanted to tell Donald that I'm calling Donald on behalf of every farm boy who grew up in the state of Indiana and never could make it to the race, but enjoyed listening to you before and after and the weeks before.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm not being funny here, but I've had a number of people tell me, and maybe you're one of these, I've had a number of people say, yep, I had the headset on when I was on the tractor plowing the field.
You got it. You got it.
You were one of those?
Yeah, I was one of those, trust me.
Okay, thank you.
As a matter of fact, my dad would only let us run the radio during the race because he wanted us to pay attention to the engine on the tractor so that if anything went wrong, we could stop.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But anyway, first of all, I have one trivia question for you, and that is, can you name a brand name of tractor that made the race as an automobile? And could you paint the picture of Pete Halsmer, who actually went to the same church that I did in Lafayette, when the year that his car, he was in the line to qualify, and they literally pulled the motor and replaced the motor in line in his Payless special car. If you could help me relive that would be great.
I do not remember that happening, but he was in the race in 81 and 82, and then back in 83, 84, 85, and then did not make it. He was the first alternate in 85, so I do not recall that particular incident.
Yeah, supposedly he had a motor that just didn't have enough punch, mm-hmm. and if I recall right, Foyt literally gave him a motor to qualify, and as they were moving through line, he was putting it in, and I remember my dad and I, we were planting beans that day and wondering if he was going to make it, and as he made it down the line, they actually switched that motor right in place. And that's kind of one of the things I miss in racing today.
Yeah.
is the fact that those kinds of things happened then, and they just seem to not happen anymore.
Well, the mechanics are not allowed to touch the engines. That's one of the things. But no, I do not recall. I mean, I remember some pretty neat things happening or weird or whatever you want to call it. I did not recall that happening with Pete Halsmer. I do remember him very well, and I haven't seen him for years, and often wondered what he's up to these days. So sorry, well, I didn't give you a very good answer there.
Hey, that's okay. Well, thanks so much. And Kurt, by the way, you do a great job on Eddie's show when you fill in for him.
Kevin, but that's okay.
Kevin. Yeah.
I appreciate it. Kurt will be here in a few minutes, but that's okay.
Great.
We're interchangeable. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
He just writes much better than I do. Phil in Rosedale, Indiana is with us next. Hello, Phil.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Fine, Phil.
Hey, Donald, I got a question. When he first laid out the track, was there any thought of turning right instead of turning left?
No, I don't think so, because already it had been established that on horse tracks that they were left-hand turns. And I've had people ask me, and so I'm the... it's a roundabout way of answering your question. The question comes up, why left-hand turns?
Yeah.
Why left? Well, it's because in this country, horse racing, a lot of the early races were either road events on county roads, existing, they just run on existing county roads, or when they did the races at the county fairs, they would use a pre-existing horse track. And for some reason, the horses do left-hand turns in this country. Now, in England, they make right-hand turns.
So that would answer my second part, why road and street racing, they start going the other direction. Is that because of the horse racing in Europe?
Oh, I don't, I can't answer that because are there no road courses where the first turn is right? I'm sure there is. And then you're talking two different things there. Is it a pre-existing road that was developed for racing, or was it a purpose-built road course?
Yeah.
But I don't. I'm just trying to think. What is an Elkhart Lake? I think turn one is a right-hand turn.
Not necessarily a turn. I guess I'm talking counterclockwise to clockwise.
Oh, I see.
From that perspective.
Don't know. Do we not have any?
I don't know. I don't know if they all go clockwise or
west
not.
To east.
Yeah.
To start.
Someone can probably help me with that. Phil, anything else for us?
Yep. No, I think that's fine. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Thank you for the call this evening. We got through all the calls. Worked out perfectly. We've reached the end of the program. We'll be back tomorrow night on the program. We're going to cover a lot of email questions just simply because of circumstances tomorrow night and location. And for those that attend Donald's class, the class will still be happening tomorrow night, and it will start on time. It's the final edition. We invite people to get on board next year at the IUPUI class for Donald's History of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and History of the 500. Donald, good to be here.
Thank
we
you,
look
Kevin.
Forward to doing this throughout the rest of the month. Tomorrow night, 6 p.m., the Talk of Gasoline Alley here on 1070 The Fan. Thanks to our studio producer, Matt Taylor. If you just joined us, the podcast will be up later on this evening.
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Okay, that sounds good. That'll be up at 1070thefan.com. Meanwhile, stay tuned. Kurt Cavan joins me. Trackside with Cavan and Kevin is coming up in just a moment on the home of the Indianapolis 500, 1070 The Fan.